brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. We actually have two guests for today. We have Chris DePlantis as well as General AJ Tata, Tony Tata, who hasn't been on in a while, but he wrote an interesting piece for Fox News about this Green Beret who Trump has suggested he's going to look back into on Twitter. But first, as I said, we have Chris on. Chris is a former Marine from 2006 to 2011 with 3rd Recon Battalion, 1st MSOB. Then went on to the Air Force and is currently now in Army National Guard. So that's kind of cool, I think, how it's three different branches, as well as working as a deputy sheriff police officer. The first question I was wondering, Chris, is that our editor, Nick Kaufman, is the one who suggested you to us. And I was wondering, where did that relationship start? Because Nick's a great guy that, you know, we love working with.
Yeah. So, one, thanks for having me on. I met Nick in, 2007. We were both in the same communication school out at Marine Corps Communication Electronics School, 29 Palms, California, the vacation spot of the Marine Corps. And we were in the same class, and we just, you know, hit it off as friends, a few other people in the class. But I think he's the only one I've actually maintained touch with. So after we graduated in 2007, I haven't actually seen him since graduation, but we've managed to maintain contact, which I'm definitely very grateful for. And I haven't, you know, done that with a lot of people, even people I even served in on deployments with, I've lost contact with, but somehow me and Nick managed to keep it together. So I'm definitely glad about that.
That's awesome. Nick is just an all-around great guy. So let's get into your origin story of joining the Marines, what inspired you to join the Marines, and what you got to do with the Marines in 1st MSOB.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in a town called Houma, Louisiana. It's about 60 miles southwest of New Orleans. And originally, I was going to join the Army right out of high school. A big group of us, we were kind of trying to figure out what we'd do with our lives. We all, about 6 or 7 of us, went to the Army recruiters. And we were kind of talking around, and then I got home that afternoon. I was telling my dad, like, hey, I think I want to join the Army. I want to graduate. And, you know, my dad's an Air Force veteran. He has no problem at the time, of course, me joining the service. But his big issue was like, hey, why don't you go to college first? You know, you have an opportunity to go. Let's try college first. The Army will always be there. The military will always be there. I was like, but let's try and go to college first. I was like, all right. So I did a year of college. And, you know, I had a great time, maybe too much fun, which is probably why I ended up dropping out. So I was kind of wandering around. I worked at Lowe's for the summer in 06. And I was just, you know, this ain't it. So I went to speak with the Air Force recruiter outside of the Army. And it didn't quite go at the time because the recruiter was about to PCS. So by the time I got everything settled, he took off. He was gone. So the door was closed, locked, had a piece of tape on it, said, you need assistance, call this number. I wrote the number down, and on my way out, it was like a shopping center. On my way out, a Marine staff sergeant stuck his head out of his door. He's like, hey, man, what's going on? And I was like, oh, just kind of heading out, just talking, you know, trying to get all the Air Force crews. Like, oh, well, so what do you want to do? I was like, well, I kind of want to get into aviation or something. Kind of just briefly, he's like, well, hey, you know, we got planes and helicopters too, you know. So he got me in the office, we were talking, and next thing I know, I'm at Recruit Depot, Parris Island.
Got another one.
kind of like, how the hell did that happen? Like, so there I was, Platoon 2001, Fox Company. And let's see, after that, I you know, made it over to McSess. That's where I met Nick. We did our school thing. They see, like, the week before graduations, they cut, you know, they cut everyone's orders. There's no, you know, all the Marines out there, you can, like, request all you want, but they're going to send you needs of the Corps. And I'm sure it's like that. It's like that for the other branches, I'm sure. You can put your wish down, but at the end of the day, you don't really have a say. So half our class ended up going to North Carolina. The other class ended up going to California. And me, I was the only one to get sent to Okinawa. So I'm leaving here. It's the first time out of the United States. Like, hey, Duplantis, Waters, 3rd Reconnaissance Battalion, Okinawa, Japan. Have fun. Good thing you liked to PT. I didn't like to PT. So that's how I ended up in Okinawa. So that was 3rd Recon. And I got there in November 07. And that week I checked in. They're like, all right, cool. We're going to get ready. We're doing a workout. We're going to Iraq next year. Like, oh, shoot, I forgot there's a war going on. Several wars going on at the time. So we worked up, did the 29 Palms workup, then spent 7 months in 2008 in Iraq. So I was a tactical data network operator. So basically it's a fancy word for a guy who has to fix the printers. Nick probably knows all about that too. So all I did was mostly it was broken up in 12-hour shifts. So I'd spend 6 hours on radio watch while teams were out on missions. Blue Force Tracker, you know, the radios and all the fun stuff, and a talk. And then the other half would be shop time. So troubleshooting the network, rerunning cables, printers, computers, anything that plugged in, essentially they would come to our shop, the comm shop, you know, have us come and fix it. Did that, and then got back. Then about a year later, I PCS'd to 1st IMSOB. I put down that was actually one of the ones on my list when they were like, well, hey, you might actually have a chance of getting your duty station preference if you know, now that you're a corporal and you've been in for a little bit. So I put down IMSOB was one of them. Now, IMSOB had only been around for 3 years roughly at the time. So I really didn't know much about it, but it sounded cool when I kind of looked into it. So I got the orders. I checked in on a Monday before Thanksgiving, and Wednesday morning I was notified that I was going to Afghanistan early January as a last-minute replacement. So I got the backpack and a bag of clothes with me, and they're like, hey, be operational in 3 weeks. You're going to Afghanistan. I'm like, all right. You know, op tempo was still super high in 2010, especially for them. So I get there. I get stuck put in the headquarters platoon, say headquarters. Yeah, the headquarters element as a comm guy. Then we deploy in late January. Somewhere between, I think I want to say about April, they moved a couple comm guys around for whatever reason. Well, I know why, but I'm not going to discuss it. So they ended up putting me at the team level. They're like, hey, you're going to go to team 3. So I was with, I got attached to team 8123. And from there, I did the same thing, a lot of radio watch, same thing. It's basically the same, actually. So I was on the team, but the most furthest non-combat POGUS guy you could be, as close as you can get to special operations without actually being special operations. But I met a lot of really good guys. That team produced 1 Navy Cross, 3 Silver Stars, a handful of Bronze Stars and other Valorous Acts. So it was a really good team to be attached. A lot of great guys. A few of them I still maintain contact with. It was nice. I was a corporal in E4 and I was the lowest ranking guy. So it was very much big boy rules in a place like that. And at a small team level like that, as you guys know, with, you know, less than 20 guys, you can kind of do that. And you kind of have to be on your own. So, I mean, I was a comm guy, but I was also, if they did vehicle ops, I was up there helping mount guns, moving ammo stores, any kind of collateral duty, because everyone kind of, you know, you have your primary, but it's like, well, we still need all this other stuff done. So, congratulations, you're now an armorer, you know. Like, okay, thank you. It was a good time, though. I really enjoyed being in that unit. And then after we got back from Afghanistan, I got back to the headquarters element, back to the comm shop, which then I got out of the Marine Corps in 2011. I tried to reenlist, but at the time there was the that drawdown. They were kind of cutting the numbers all across the DOD, and I'd just been promoted to sergeant not too long, but at the time for that in my MOS in the 06 field, they were like, all right, well, you're not a staff sergeant, you're not a corporal, so the boat spaces for sergeants are closed out for reenlistment, so I could not reenlist. By the time I found options to stay in the Marine Corps, I was already kind of over it. I'd spent months trying to, like, deal with the bureaucracy, and by the time I got, like, all right, here's how you can reenlist, I was like, well, nah, man, you guys done – if this is what it's like just to stay in to keep the job I have, maybe I should just do something. So I ended up doing that. Oh, I did skip over part. I did go to MARSOC selection in 2011. I, trained up, got physically fit, you know, got up to the swim levels, rucking, went to selection. I did not make it past land nav. So I made it up to about 5 weeks into the course, the pre-selection selection. Got to the land navigation portion, spent the whole, you know, those 5 days up in AP Hill, Virginia, just kind of wandering around the trees by myself. So I didn't quite cut it at the end. So they dropped me. I guess they figured, like, well, you didn't pass this port. We're not going to put you through the last, like, team week because you're not going to get selected. Which, you know, at first, you know, I was very bummed out about it because I trained physically, but I didn't train any land nav. And that's on me. And, you know, I can't, you know, I respect the institution. That's the whole point of having a selection.
Sure.
Is, you know, hey, I didn't make the cut, so I definitely couldn't hold it against anyone but myself. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, they're like, well, I got invited back. Well, you can come back in April or whatever the date was. But I was like, well, maybe it's just not for me. You know, I'm in a good position with the communication shop. And then that's when all the whole, like, you can't reenlist came up. So that was the Marine Corps in a nutshell. I'm sure there's some in-between stuff if you guys have any questions about any of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be kind of a crushing thing to have this dream to go into MARSOC, which was relatively new at the time, and not be able to be a part of it. So, I mean, is it just something that you often reflect upon, or do you wish that you would have, prepared a little bit differently possibly?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely weighed on me for a while. Because I mean, it's a big deal. Just to make it to selection is not easy. They don't just send you like, hey, I want to go. No, it was like, all right, well, here, run a PFT. All right, let's go on a 12-mile ruck to see if you can even handle that. You know, this is all stuff we did informally. And then, you know, I got the physical done and I got it. And you know, I was swimming every day, running every day, or different various PTs every day, just busting my butt, sweating it out, earning it. Just to kind of like, and then I neglected, you know, other parts of it. Like I didn't, you know, I was like, oh, well, land nav, you know, just get a compass and a map. It can't be that hard. Well, apparently it was, you know, I made most of the points. It was, I think it was a timing issue. I think it was, they just said I failed it. They didn't really explain why I failed it. You know, I made some of the points. It's similar to, I guess you call it like the star, I guess that you guys do it SFAS. You got to go find a bunch of random points.
Yeah, out in the woods.
Yeah, it was very similar. My cadre there, the, you know, you were broken down in the, I want to say it was like groups of like 20, and my cadre was actually a retired Delta operator, retired Sergeant Major Edward Bugarin. I definitely will remember
Bugarin,
him.
Yeah, I know exactly who that is.
Yeah, he was my
he's
cadre.
A Pacific Islander, I believe. He was one of the original members of the unit.
A beast, man. This guy, he was 61 at the time.
Wow.
And we're doing like our rucks and, you know, like, and he's coming like just flying, and he's got a ruck too. And he's like just flying by us. Like, you know, I'm 24 at the time and I'm, you know, like I'm in pretty good shape. And this dude's like, all right, let's go. And he just like, he's casually jogging behind us. And, you know, I really wish we had more time. He didn't really get to share any stories, but just being around him and the way he was, his super professionalism, they were definitely learning from one of the best, you know, because then I went and looked him up. He didn't really give a whole lot of information about it. We actually had several, I think a couple Delta guys, a few Green Berets, because at this time selection was still kind of being developed, I think, to what it is now. So they were taking a lot of, you know, kind of how SFAS is and using integrating into SOF how you guys do it and how MARSOC does it now. Now they're very institutionalized. They have their schoolhouse, the selection, the pipeline. It was a lot of growing pains, of course, anything new like that, especially if you're dealing with the Marine Corps, because all the Marine Corps does is if it's something that's different, they don't like it.
So here's something I was actually wondering, Chris, and I'm sure other people are too, and I think is part of the reason that Nick suggested you come on with us is, you know, serving in three different branches, I think, is pretty interesting to people. And what made you go that route?
Well, I will tell you this. It's definitely an example. I wouldn't definitely do this if I probably would have done a different route. So coming out of the Marine Corps, you know, I was kind of – I just met my wife, who soon to be wife. We got married in December that year, which, you know, trying to figure out what to do. Luckily, she had a job. So I was able to kind of bum around for a little bit, kind of wander. When my dad was in the Air Force. So for a part of my life, I grew up on Maxwell Air Force Base out in Alabama. And I remember that. And I remember being inspired by that just in general for the military thing. Not necessarily branch specific, but just being around it, I enjoyed it. You know, I have a ton of respect for my dad. We live in Wyoming now. They still live in Louisiana. So they come visit as often as they can. And I always enjoy spending time with him because it's just, we have a great relationship. But I was always inspired by him, and I still am. I still look up to him. So I got out of the Marine Corps, and I kind of started bouncing around kind of recruiting offices, kind of Googling stuff. Just like, I actually spoke to the Coast Guard recruiter. And I was like, yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm getting out, or I just got out. You know, I got 5 years in. I'm an E5. Like, oh, okay, cool. But you come in, you have to go down to E3. And then once you get MOS qualified, then you'll bump up to E4. I'm like, whoo, chief, I'm not taking two rank reduction. I'll take one, but not two. Like, that's money. That was like $400 a month I was going to lose out. I was like, no, sorry. Appreciate it. Thank you. And I talked to the active duty Air Force and just kind of wandering. And I end up can't remember. Oh yeah, recruiter in the mall out there in Riverside. Temecula. Ended up going talk to the Air Force Reserve recruiter. I was like, okay, well, I think reserves would be a good deal because I can kind of still kind of play military, but then not like deal with the Monday through Friday garbage games. So I ended up enlisting in January 12 into the reserves as an air transportation, which is the MOS 2T2. So anytime you fly Space A, if you get on a C-17, C-130, C-5 Air Force, the guys processing you, loading the bags, running the forklifts, that's the air transportation guys. They're going to be out in the flight line in the camis. They're not wearing flight suits because they're non-flyers. So if you've ever passed through a deployment or on overseas or even a CONUS, you've gone through an air trans shop or at least through their facilities, their, you know, metal detectors. It looks like a passenger terminal. You get your fake airline ticket to go get on a C-130. You're passing through there. Go those guys.
That's weird as hell. I've never even heard of that.
What's that? The MOS?
Or well, I mean, taking military transport and like you go through a metal detector and you get a ticket. Like what the fuck? And then what? You get your 240 Bravo and get on the back of the airplane anyway.
Well, that's mostly for the Space A. So like you got like. It's like you'll see this if you go to like Charleston Air Force Base, like is the big one. So you walk in and it looks like a Delta Airlines terminal. There's the baggage turnstile. And now these are for like Space A. So you get like retirees or someone on leave just sitting there in their civilians. And a lot of people pass through there. So yeah, it's kind of like a not as invasive TSA. You'll run your bag through a metal detector. I don't think I've ever patted anyone down. You'll walk through just a regular, you know, put your keys in the bowl. You'll get a ticket. Yeah. Of course, it's free, but it's just to show that you're going on this specific flight. Because especially out of Charleston, they fly to Germany a lot. But the air trans shop I work out of, a Keesler Air Force Base, was just a hangar. And we only processed people coming to and from drill. So it was like our guys we were processing. So we weren't scanning their bags. You give them the brief, like, you know, no flash photography, no explosives. You got any weapons, just keep them put in your bag. Like, stuff you're not supposed to bring on a plane anyway. It was a good gig. I worked out of Keesler Air Force Base for about 3 years doing that. It was I mean, I did enjoy it. If you enjoy aviation but you don't want to fly, that's a good job to go to, because you can be near the plane, you can touch the plane, but once it takes off, you're good. Like, you can like watch it fly away and like, oh, that's cool, and then go back to the shop.
That's cool, man. Mm-hmm. One of the last things I was wondering actually was a core. I don't know what you could say, so this is one of those things where you could just not talk about it. But according to Nick, you have some pretty interesting aspirations of where you want to go from here. Do you want to elaborate on that a little?
I have no idea what he's talking about specifically. Okay. Actually, I don't. I mean, so. I mean, I've interviewed for a federal job, if that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, I believe so.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I can talk about that for a minute. I'll leave the agency out and whatnot. Just, I don't know. I signed so many papers. I don't know what I even – I'm sure I signed a couple of non-disclosures, so just in case. Yeah, I mean, I interviewed for a federal job. I made it all the way up to background, polygraph. Basically, as far as I know, I've – made it through that gambit. I, you know, received an email saying that the packet is under adjudicative review, which I think it's just a fancy word for they're combing through the entire thing. Because it would be a job out in DC. So they're combing through the entire packet now. I did all the fun stuff, the interview, the I think we all here feel the same about polygraphs.
Thought they're bullshit.
Yeah. So I did that. That was the best 8 hours of my life.
I've never had to take. I mean, I'm the odd man out, being someone who's never been in the military, never been, I don't know, accused of a crime or anything. I've never had to take an 8 hour polygraph.
I've never taken a polygraph either. I mean, I never had to.
I mean, it was just it's for the job. Like I just if I never have to do it again, I would not be sad. Like I get put it this way, I get why people take plea deals.
I mean, do you get nervous to being in there for 8 hours, or do you start to question, am I giving the right answers or that type of thing?
The general air of it is nervousness, just like any interview. Yeah. It's just you, the agent or the officer, the investigating. It's a quiet room. There's no windows. There's no contact to the outside world. It's just really personal. Like anything you can think they're going to ask, any obscured, random, like – stuff you wouldn't think of, or they're going to ask it. So, I mean, you're going to be prepared for the answer. You're going to be like, oh crap. Something you suppressed yourself. Like I suppressed that memory for a reason. Now you're digging it up. Like,
yeah. I talked to a retired Green Beret one time. He told me he was applying for the CIA. They put him on the polygraph and they started asking him about having sex with his mother. did he enjoy fucking farm animals and stuff like that? And he was like, what the hell kind of agency is this? And he was like, that was about the point. He decided, no thanks.
I don't think we got that weird, but it got pretty close.
This would have been back in like the 70s.
Kind of random stuff too. Stuff you wouldn't think that would be like an issue, but like, I won't let any secrets out just in case I don't want to break any sort of agreements.
Definitely a different culture at that time from what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, back in the day, I mean, they definitely used to ask you like, are you a homosexual? You know, all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah.
Those are like the days of, what was it that Jim West said during the Inside the Team Room? He had to like slaughter a goat.
Well, what do you mean?
Remember he spoke about that with Wellcow during the Inside the Team Room. He had to like slaughter an animal himself.
And train it? I mean, we do that still to this day.
Oh, okay.
Survival training.
I'm unaware of that. So yeah. I thought that was like an old school thing.
No.
Sierra 18 Delta.
Yeah, I mean, I did live tissue training several times while I was in. So, I mean, yeah, that stuff continues to this day.
I had no idea. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't get to do any good stuff like that. I mean, I was a comm guy, but you know, actually, I just thought about something. Back to the comm thing. Back at MSOB in 2011, that because we're still seeing it today. MARSOC is still having a little bit of growing pains, but they've really done well. And at the time, that was the year that the shooters, the Raiders, actually got their MOS. The 0372 MOS. They finally got their MOS designator. Because up until that point, they were just former force guys or other guys who went through the schoolhouse, but they didn't have an MOS yet. They still maintained their old MOSs at the time, I believe. So that was when they finally, like, all right, you guys have an MOS. Raiders is now an MOS. But they weren't called Raiders at the time. The name was kind of getting tossed about. They were still playing with the idea. But like I said, it's the Marine Corps. They're not, like, really big on wanting to give an identity to anyone outside. You know, every Marine's a rifleman. Well, if you've been to a Marine Corps firing range, you know that's not true. That's not true. It looks great on a bumper sticker, but there's some people out there I wouldn't trust with a pencil sharpener. I mean, and people probably say that about me. That's cool. Whatever. You don't pay my bills. Towards the end of that year, the enablers, such as like EOD, myself, comm guys, armors and whatnot, they were given the designator 8071 special operations capable. So I was I was in that first group of communicators who received the new MOS 8071. And I think that would be similar to like the enablers. Like speaking wrong, let me know. Like the Maroon Beret or the Red Beret, whatever. What the fuck, the Paratrooper Beret?
Yeah, it's Maroon.
Maroon, okay, thank you. The Maroon Beret guys who are attached to the teams, you know, like your comm guys, your and stuff like that. I think it would be something similar like to that. Except there's no designator, there's no pin, there's no beret or nothing like that. So you have the MOS, you know you have the MOS, and then you operate with your team.
Well, all those guys are special. They're under SOCOM. They're part of the unit. But yeah, they wouldn't have, you know, say the Special Forces tab and the 18 series MOS identifier. So yeah, I guess it's sort of similar.
Yeah, it's basically the same thing. Just same, like, I mean, and, you know, the Raiders are lucky to finally get their own insignia finally. Mm-hmm. Just so we can, like, at least point them out. And that was the whole point. Mostly of them getting insignia that way when they're up at, you know, JSOC or anywhere in SOCOM, that they're not just blending in as just any other Marine. Like, okay, that's a Raider. This is a guy we need to talk to, or these are the guys. It's nice that you know, they're finally recognized for that, with the, you know, push that we're all the same. No, we're not. And then, I forgot to throw that in there with the Marine Corps stuff.
No, not a problem. Appreciate you mentioning that. And we do have General Tata standing by. So wrapping things up here, I know you have your small business that people could check out, Southern Crossblades, which is at Southern Crossblades on Instagram. But thanks for coming on with us, man. I think this has been interesting. And a lot of people might wonder, you know, can you make that transition from, you know, three different branches and into what you're doing now? So I think a lot of people, this will be something that they learned something from.
Yeah. And, you know, as I said, again, when I left the Air Force Reserve Air Guard, the reason I left that was because I was trying to get a flight air crew, and they didn't have anything available here. So I called over to the Army Guard. We have a dust off medical medevac detachment, UH-60s. So I called them. I was like, hey, I want to fly. And they're like, okay, we'll double slot you in a position. So I'm going to go to the Blackhawk repair course here coming up in February, you know, learn how to fix it. And then
that's cool.
Hopefully work on my crew progression. So while I've been drilling with them the last year, I have gotten to fly a little bit, an annual tour with them. It's a great unit. They're actually going out the door soon, out to support OEF, because that's still going on. And, you know, it's wild that we're still doing that. My last deployment was 8 years ago. And I'm still thinking, like, these – of course, now I'm in my 30s, so these kids, I'm feeling 18, 19 years old, they're going right out to the same place as I was almost 10 years ago. It's just wild that we're – you know, this GWAT is still going on. And that – it's – you know, the transition's easy. While all the branches are very different, there's – they have a lot more in common than people would actually want to think. Most of the differences come in, like, formalities, uniforms – you know, the old school, old fashioned, you know, branch rivalry stuff. But when you actually get down and get to work, you know, you got a mission, you got to do it. You work with who you got to work with. There's tons of prior Marines, sailors, former Air Force guys, former active duty Army guys. We're a mix of all kinds of troops that are now we have, like, this is our goal now. So if you are thinking about getting out and, you know, whatever your active duty is, you want to go into reserves, look at the other branches, see what they have to offer. you know, don't be so closed-minded about it. It's a good time. And yeah, my small business, it started out as a hobby. It just turned into a small business somehow. Unfortunately, if you do go to my site, you know, Southern Cross Blades, you look up stuff. I can't make anything right now because someone stole all my stuff out of my garage weeks ago. So all my power tools are gone, so I can't make anything right now.
Jesus.
But give me a follow. Check it out. You can kind of watch me progress, hopefully, back into it. Follow my day-to-day stuff and whatnot. My Twitter is Task Force Dupe, Task Force D-U-P-E. I just kind of run my mouth on Twitter like everyone else. I mean, why not? And then and also Facebook, Southern Cross Blades on Facebook. I don't get on that one as much because Facebook is just being a pain in the butt right now just algorithms, and it keeps kicking me off for some reason.
All right, man. Well, hey, thanks for coming on with us. I have General Tata waiting, so I got to get to him. But appreciate it, Chris. And once again, people could check you out on Instagram, as you said, Southern Cross Blades. And we'll talk to you soon, man.
All right, thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
And if any of this, I'm holding Nick Kaufman accountable if no one likes this one. Take care, guys.
Thanks, man. Thank you. So back on with us for the first time in a really long time, he's been on the show twice, is General Tony A.J. Tata, former Army Brigadier General from 81 to 2009 and best-selling author of several of your own books, a book with Nick Irving as well. I know the latest is Dark Winter, which we'll get into, but the reason I wanted to have you on kind of last minute, which I appreciate you jumping on with us, is that you wrote this piece for Fox News about what's at the moment probably the most controversial issue in special operations in the military right now, and that's this guy by the name of Matt Goldstein, who is being held right now in a charge for murder. And you wrote a piece for Fox News, which is titled "Trump is Perfectly Within His Authority to Review Case of Green Beret Charged with Murder." To be honest, I personally was not all that up to speed on what went down, so reading your piece gave me some background. So maybe the audience would want to get into that, because I was unaware that statements Matt made on Fox News pretty much incriminated himself.
Well, incriminated may be too strong a word. It certainly gave the DOD reason to reopen their investigation, or they saw reason is probably a better way to put it, to reopen the investigation into him. In 2010, we have to remember what was happening with the intelligence community at the time. You had Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, who was releasing state secrets to WikiLeaks. We had Stan McChrystal, who was rather embattled in command in Afghanistan. You had the Obama administration trying to soften the rules for detainees in the wake of Abu Ghraib and Gitmo, perceived scandals at Gitmo, and lots of other things consuming the intelligence community at the time. And one of the impacts was that the processing of detainees was being made much more difficult for commanders on the ground. And so what you have happen is Goldstein is operating with Marines in the southern part of Afghanistan, and two of his Marines are killed by an improvised explosive device. They immediately, like good Special Forces soldiers do, go on the offensive and on a kill capture mission and capture the bomb maker, and they bring him to the base to be detained. And this is where, in my view, there's some investigating that needs to happen, because what happened is allegedly Goldstein, the intelligence community did not take the bomb maker and process him. And what is supposed to happen, when I was the deputy commanding general there, you know, one of the parts of my portfolio, many parts, you know, other than combat ops and air assaults and all of that kind of stuff, was detention operations, which, you know, nobody wanted. It was like, give it to Mikey, he'll like it. And the rules, so I'm very familiar with this. The rules were, if the individual was a threat to U.S. forces and or had current intelligence value, then he should be detained, given a detainee number, and processed up to Bagram Detention Facility. And the intelligence community is in charge of that. And the people who should have taken this bomb maker and processed him did not do that. And so for whatever reason, that did not happen. Well, and so
when
from
you
that
say
point,
intelligence community, why would DOD not be processing him and handing him over to the Afghan government at that point?
Well, so for at least when I was there, Jack, in 2006-07 timeframe, we took these people, the intelligence community within the military intelligence community, would process him up to Bagram, where we would interrogate and to try to determine and establish, intelligence that could lead us to, very current future operations, and we could keep the pressure on the enemy. And so, and we had a detention site down at Kandahar where the guy should have been held, and then ultimately they're processed, if they're a longer term, up to Bagram. And so the commander of the intel community, the military intelligence community at Kandahar, failed, because here was a guy who was both a threat and had current intelligence value, and he was not put into the detainee system. And so you have Goldstein left with this guy on his hands. And so this is where two accounts verge, right? One account has him, walking the guy off base and shooting him in the head and then carrying him back and throwing him in the burn pit. Another account has him releasing him to the wild, as he is required to do if he is not processed within 3 days. And then shortly thereafter, the bomb maker and some of his affiliates are killed in an ambush. If it's the latter scenario, there's no issue, right? If it's the former scenario, then that's a violation of the Geneva Conventions. So that's that. I tried to write the article in a very sort of neutral tone, other than to say, because everybody's freaking out about Trump. Trump's a commander in chief, and here's a young soldier, a young officer that served his country, was a Silver Star recipient, which is a high award for combat action, and he in his CIA interview, no doubt a poly, he tells the truth about what he did, and then the CIA refers it over to DOD, who then gives him administrative punishment of removing a special forces tab and stripping him of his Silver Star, which is pretty severe.
Yeah.
And now, but because it was administrative, it's not technically double jeopardy. And so now he's in an interview with Brett Baer in 2016 and makes a comment, and perhaps he should have been better coached before going on national TV, but makes a comment that then DOD, the Obama DOD, opens up another investigation into him. And now we are where we are with this case. And I've seen his attorney on Fox News talking about, he didn't do anything in cold blood, that he released the detainee and the detainee went and walked into an ambush. So, part of my article, I say, people pretend to know what's going on, but it's just speculation. And only a few people know what really happened. This soldier deserves, every bit of his constitutional rights that he fought so hard for, and he to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. which, you know, that should be a very high standard, just as it is for every citizen in our nation.
I absolutely believe that, you know, this retired officer is entitled to due process. It's important to keep that in mind. And I guess a big part of it is, what did he say during this interview with the CIA? And as you say, I believe he was on a polygraph. If, you know, it was a case where they let the detainee go, they outprocessed him from the facility, let him go, and he was killed, you know, subsequently by some sort of enemy action or whatever, but, you know, infighting, in Afghanistan amongst, Afghan factions, that's a pretty clean cut case of, right. It not being the fault of the U.S. Army. Things like that happen all the time.
That's exactly right. And I mean, once you step outside of the fence in any of these FOBs, you're fair game. You're in the Serengeti, and so it is a case where it all revolves around what actually happened and what did he say happened. You know, what did that polygraph say? And you know, there's if indeed it was a polygraph, but I believe that it was. There are rules on admissibility of polygraphs. And so this case becomes very complex, that if the DOD is using a polygraph to conduct an investigation, one that they've already done and determined that there was not sufficient evidence to charge him with anything, only to do administrative action, then it seems to me that it's a stretch that we've got going on here, because the he's already been reviewed once. So now this is 7 years of hell that he and his family are being put through by a system that, you know, has extra legal powers that is as onerous as any city hall in the country. And you definitely can't fight them as well as they can fight you, because they have legions of attorneys that will tack on every single possible lesser charge to make you plea. And so, I mean, it's, you know, the prosecution is going to ramp up on this, and they're going to go after him with fangs. And that's the part that bothers me, is that, you know, here's this great soldier, and you know, if he violated the Geneva Convention, that's one story. But, you know, evidently he didn't, or they would have pressed charges against him back in 2011 after his CIA interview.
At the same time, I mean, don't you think Gallstein has kind of brought this on himself? I mean, we know, and I'm sure he wasn't thinking this at the time, but when you get put on a polygraph, it's essentially junk science. They just put you on this, make-believe machine that supposedly can tell if you're telling the truth or not. And they do that just to shake you up, just to make you nervous and scare you, hoping that you're going to confess to things. What happened here in this case. And then DOD, they gave him an administrative punishment, as you talked about. And it seems like DOD was just hoping this thing was going to go away and blow over. And then he went on Fox News and made these comments, and it's like, oh, damn, like now they have to get involved again.
Right, right. And, he would have been well enough to leave it alone, that's for sure. You're exactly right, Jack. And I don't know why he continued to talk about this, particularly if it was 51-49%, whether or not he was within the law or not within.
If the charge really isn't true, he may have been talking about it because he was trying to refute that and defend himself. But I mean, I don't know. I'm just speculating.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. When you have some kind of bogus claim against you, then you try to, clear your name.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Ian said, I don't know that many people knew about this thing. Right. I mean, it's one thing that you have a limited circle of friends and family and soldiers and so forth that with whom you operated that, know whether or not, you know, this happened or didn't happen, or, you know, that something might have besmirched your name. It's another thing to go on national, the most watched cable news show in the country, and then announce that you killed somebody, and to say it in such a way that almost makes DOD then to have to reopen this thing. And so, yeah, I mean, it's you know, there's a little bit of a self-inflicted wound here, I think. But now it's got national attention, and, you know, whatever happened, I think the truth will come out and the chips will fall where they may. And my whole point for writing that article was the president was receiving the standard dosage of, you know, 92% of hate that he gets anytime he does anything. And my point was, you know, he's perfectly within his right. And if this guy's going to be, you know, rifled through the system, I think President Trump is very deliberate with his messaging, because with this, I think what he was saying is tread carefully, treat this guy properly, and let the chips fall where they may. I'm going to take a look at it.
But do you think that's just really something that should be sent out as a tweet? Isn't that like a phone call to your to the DOJ or FBI or whoever the investigating authority is?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we can all debate, you know, the president's communication style, but I think he sees the press getting a hold of this, and the way the president communicates is he pole vaults over the press to his followers through Twitter. And he's said that he's got his own media source in Twitter, and, you know, for all the love and the hate that comes his way, you know, it's how he communicates. And so it didn't surprise me. Yeah. I mean, sure. Pick up the phone and say, hey, Secretary Mattis, you know, watch this one close because I'm watching it. You know, that's probably typically how it would be handled. But, you know, this president handles things differently.
I totally get that. But it goes back to what we were speaking of earlier about due process and how this soldier deserves to be tried in a court of law. For the president to pole vault over the bureaucracy and over the press and go directly to his followers, that starts heading towards mob rule as opposed to due process.
Well, yeah, I don't, you know, disagree with he's got a lot of people energized about this right now. The real question, though, you know, I read a couple of articles where that said he was exerting undue command influence on this. And I do not see it as that. You know, I can remember as a commander, you know, whether it was a summary courts martial or general courts martial or, you know, Article 15 or whatever, you know, I would have a conversation with whomever and say, you know, look, let's make sure we get this right. This is a very challenging case. There's some attention that we've got here. And I just want to make sure that we follow the process. And, you know, 90% of the time I would say nothing. But, you know, there was, if I had a case that was touchy or had some, you know, big time media attention on it, I would have a very neutral conversation, and I would have my JAG in there making sure I didn't say anything stupid. And so my whole point for writing that article was that it was not, in my view, undue command influence as a lot of the left has been saying it was.
The only other thing I'd want to ask you you're absolutely right. It's within the president's purview to review these cases. But to issue a presidential pardon, don't we have to have a conviction first?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think he said anything about a pardon.
Right. But why else would he review it? Right.
Yeah. Well, I think he was very deliberately communicating tread carefully. And you know, if the facts show that he went out and shot this guy in the head and then dragged him and threw him into burn pit, I don't think he'll be getting a presidential pardon. I may be wrong, but if the facts show that he released the guy, you know, undid his handcuffs and said, you know, go forth and do great things. And then 20 minutes later, he's in an ambush and killed. That's a different thing. And you know, if it's shown that he put the guy on the path and led him into the ambush and all of that, well, that's where it gets a little dicey. So it's a tough case. And because, you know, we all want to believe our warriors in combat are doing the best thing. And, you know, by all accounts, this is a great American. And, you know, I can remember when I, you know, I had, you know, one of my lieutenants from the 82nd Airborne when I was a battalion commander was then a company commander for me in the 10th Mountain Division when I was the deputy commander general there. And I get a phone call that from Mick Nicholson, who just left there as the general in charge of Afghanistan, and who was a brigade commander for me. And he says, you know, hey, sir, did you hear about Doug? And I'm like, no, what's going on? And, you know, he was killed. I threw my phone into my wall. I called my aide and I said a lot of things that I can't say on radio.
You can say whatever you want here, but
Well, I said we're going to go find the SOB who did this. And, you know, and of course me, you know, like there were like 1,000 troops in between me and whoever did this. But I understand the emotion that goes with losing people with whom you've served and who you love and who you led. And that's where, you know, the rule of or the law of land warfare and the Geneva Conventions and all that are important, because there are emotions that guide us at times, as opposed to, you know, the mission and reason. But that's not to say that's what's happened here. I'm just saying I understand how the good major, then captain, felt leading his A team in combat and losing men, and certainly the primal urge to you know, put those men back together and send them home to their families whole and happy and healthy, and meanwhile stopping that from ever happening again. I mean, it's an indescribable emotion and feeling that I'm sure you know.
Yeah, I certainly, I mean, definitely not advocating war crimes or executions, but yes, I understand the frustration. In 2009 in Iraq, it was like a revolving door. I mean, we would catch these guys, we knew they were bad, we'd turn them over to Iraq, and like some judge in some Iraqi court would just be like, hey, it's amnesty day, you all go free, back out on the streets, and do it all over again.
Right, right, yeah. So I had to process every week. You know, we had like, I want to say 500 people in the Bagram detention facility. And, you know, all the way from like supposedly bin Laden's driver who had been captured early in the war. Yep. And here it was 6 years later. And, you know, was he a threat? Did he have intel value? Maybe. But they... intel guys, the military intelligence guys, brought to me weekly, if not more frequently, packets where they essentially reviewed every detainee. And this was part of the process. It was part of the bureaucratic review that all these detainees went through that essentially said, is detainee X still a threat, and is detainee X, does detainee X still have intelligence value? And so they would provide their assessment. And if the answer was no to both of those, then they would say, we recommend releasing detainee X, or we recommend keeping him for the following reasons. But, you know, it was sort of like the prison problem here. You only had so much cell space. And so then what we did is we implemented a system when I was there that we would send an emissary out to the village wherever we captured this guy. And lots of times we had your basic rifleman who was paid $10 to go sit in an ambush and that kind of thing. And, you know, he was 51% to 49%. You know, influenceable, you know, could be influenced in a certain way. And we would talk to the village elder and say, do you want this guy back or no? And if we bring him back, are you going to take charge of him and make sure he doesn't do anything stupid again? And, you know, more often than not, that worked. And we had very low recidivism with regard to when we did that. And of course, you know, on the higher value guys, you know, we kept them and kept them off the battle. Most of them were hardcore assholes that you wanted off the battlefield and kept off the battlefield, and we kept them off the battlefield. But there was this constant pressure from the bureaucrats in D.C. to, you know, treat everybody nice and all that, which we did. You know, they had a better life. They got glasses for the first time in their life, and they could see better, and they received daily, you know, they had medical care, dental care. They received much better care than homeless vets here in the United States receive. That's for damn sure.
Oh, wasn't there also the question of, you know, the United States Army isn't really set up to run prisons overseas, you know, wartime prisons indefinitely, which is kind of the situation that, you know, we found ourselves in.
Yeah, for sure. We were having to rotate, and the military police equivalent from all the services who would have to go through some training on detention operations, and which are very different than cruising in your, you know, cop car around a military base. And you know, the Air Force, when I was there, we had the Air Force that were, you know, military police that were filling out the guard force. And it was, you know, it was some hundred airmen that were there. And I had Army colonel who was in charge of all of that. She was the commander of the Bagram detention facility and all detainee operations throughout the country. And there were about 15 different field detention sites where the guys like Goldstein could take their guy, throw him in there, and then turn to the military intelligence people and say, here's my guy, interrogate him, and tell me what to do with him. And that's how it should have worked. But anyway, the Air Force, they only deploy people for every 4 months. And so, you know, in my 13, 14 months in combat, I had three or four iterations of people, you know, who were constantly changing out and having to relearn. And it made it very, very challenging to try to sort of maintain order. And you know, it's like any prison. They're gonna all, you know, come together, and you had the international human rights people come in, and you had the international Red Cross come in, and so it was very, very transparent, and at the same time it was very challenging because it was not a standard prison. It was basically supply cages that we kept these people in, and it's what we inherited. And every time we said, oh, well, we need to build a prison, you know, there wasn't enough money, and, you know, it wouldn't be done for a couple of years anyway. And it was a tough situation. And before I had gotten there, four really hard Al-Qaeda guys had escaped.
Oh, shit.
This detention facility was right next to the Joint Operations Headquarters, and you know, where the generals and, you know, Joint Operations Center was and all that. Literally, it was across the parking lot. And the exfil route for these detainees after they did the big investigation, which I read coming into the country, was right through the parking lot of the Joint Operations Center. And so, it could not have been any more embarrassing. And then they walked out the front gate, they changed clothes, and they acted like they were, you know, the laundry people or something that did the laundry for the troops on the base, and then just walked right out the front gate.
Slick.
Yeah. It was, you know, like, a movie. But, so, you know, Goldstein, you know, I hope the best for the young man. And, you know, he's, it's got some national attention now, and I want him to receive justice, whatever that may be.
Yeah, well said. Switching gears here, I know that you have a new book out, Dark Winter. It's the fifth book in the Jake Mohegan thriller series. What could people expect from this one?
Yeah, so Ian, that, Dark Winter, Booklist gave it a great starred review, calling it a techno, epic techno thriller. Essentially, my agent or editor said, give me World War III. And I said, Gary, you know, World War III has been done. And he said, you're a general, figure out a new way to do it. and so I'm like, okay. And I, right around that time, my Facebook page had just disappeared. And there was nobody I could get in touch with. You know, it was, you know, you could email the help thing, but there's no email. You could just submit a question.
Yeah,
and a few days later, Facebook contacts me and says, well, you were impersonating someone else. I'm like, I'm only me. And somebody had been impersonating me.
And
so they left his page, but I guess took mine down. And it, despite, you know, like 8,000 followers and all of that stuff. And they took down my author page and my personal page. And so I thought, that's some pretty unmitigated power right there.
Yeah.
That you can just silence somebody like that. And then I had been reading a book called Search and Destroy, Why You Can't Trust Google. And it was a fascinating book about how powerful Google is. And so I said, well, you know, how about I make, Ian is the first name of the bad guy, Ian.
Oh, nice.
Ian Gorham is a tech magnate. And he's, you know, 29 or so, and he's bored. His company owns a company called Manaslu, which is one of the mountains in the Himalayan range that people climb for practice to climb Mount Everest. And it's supposedly tougher than Everest, but not as high. And so he calls his company Manaslu, just like Bezos called his company Amazon. And so you've got Manaslu Incorporated, that has passed Facebook and Google and Amazon and all their respective market share categories. And so he's now bored. He's got his GDP is larger than most countries. And so he has this globalist vision, and he wants to remake the world, particularly the United States, in the image of this globalist can't we all get along vision that he has. And he does so, he wants to do so by burning the United States essentially to the ground by eliminating mutual assured destruction between America and Russia, Iran, and North Korea. He creates something he calls the RINK Alliance, or Russia, Iran, and North Korea. And he disables through hacking the U.S. nuclear capability, and he enables the Russia, Iran, and North Korean after disabling them and cutting a deal with them. And now there's three people that can shut down what is about to happen, and Jake Mohegan has to go to Iran and North Korea and all these places and capture these people and walk them through a biometric chamber to shut down the nuclear countdown that's happening. And so he's got to capture them, keep them alive, and walk them through gait recognition, DNA, and all that, about seven different identifying factors. And there's a lot of high tech machine learning, artificial intelligence involved. And it's a good read. It's a fun read. And it's the first time Jake goes global. If you remember, the first four books are all take place in North Carolina, and now Jake is global.
Interesting.
And it's a fun, fast-paced kind of Tom Clancy-esque Vince Flynn kind of read.
You sold me. Sounds interesting. This is probably a topic where I would agree with the campus hippies that, you know, some of these tech giants and these social media companies have monopolized so much of the market that I think it's time for the federal government to go in and nationalize or break up some of these companies into smaller companies.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Jack. The question is, are they media outlets or are they neutral platforms that they claim to be? I think it's pretty clear that, you know, I wrote an article for Fox not too long ago about Google. And it was interesting. It was highly critical of Google, and it was the number one trending article on Google. If you Googled China and Google, and it was essentially Google refused, because over 8,000 Googlers, as they're called, Google employees, protested the Google helping the U.S. military with artificial intelligence on Project Maven to read, you know, facial features and all that kind of thing to help identify targets better. So Google stopped doing that because of their people protesting.
But they'll help out China, no problem.
Yeah, exactly. That was the point of the article. But they'll do Operation Dragonfly, the search engine that they're developing for China, that, you know, if you type in student protest, you get no results. If you type in President Xi, you only get positive results. Wow. And so they're helping out one of the most oppressive communist regimes in the world ever. But refuse to help the country that, you know, gives them the capitalist and democratic foundations that have allowed them to thrive. That is the height of irony and duplicity.
I don't use the term lightly, but I mean, that's why I really think some of these companies are evil.
That's
really, really bad.
And the irony is that Google's motto is do no evil. They are evil. So.
Yeah, the thing that makes me think, I mean, this is really less of an issue than the China stuff, but the thing that makes me think all these tech companies are in collusion was, you know, there was the recent, I've heard people refer to it like the depersoning of Alex Jones, how he was kicked off.
Deplatforming.
Dead. But I've heard depersoning, too, people have said, kicked off Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and then PayPal almost simultaneously. And now the more recent one is Gavin McGinnis. Gavin McGinnis has been taken off of everything. And, you know, he's a controversial guy. He's made statements that people think encourage violence. But I think it's just interesting that it's all done at once on every one of these platforms. It wasn't like, you know, 1 month this platform kicked him off for saying this.
They recently did it to Milo Yiannopoulos, kicked him off Patreon and all that. And these are people who I don't agree with what they say. I really don't like them. I think Milo is a Nazi, quite frankly. But that said, it sets this precedent that these, as you said, these companies working together hand in hand are able to deplatform points of view that they don't like entirely. And that could be a frightening trend for the future.
Yeah, you know, I was watching Jim Jordan on Fox News or somewhere, and it was after Brin had, or not, you know, the Google CEO had testified, and he said, you know, it's just interesting to me, and he started talking about Twitter, but you know, they're all kind of the same. They're all super left. They're all Silicon Valley, and they're all, or you know, out on the West Coast there, and. You know, Jordan said, you know, me, Meadows, and one other conservative congressman, we all got shadow banned, but no Democrats got shadow banned. And then when we protested, Twitter came back and said, oh, we're sorry, that was an algorithmic error. And it's not an algorithmic error. It's some, you know, teeny bopper in there saying, I don't like these guys. Let's shut them down for a little while. And they're snickering about it. And so they shut them down. It's kind of like why my Facebook page was removed, you know. And it's like, yeah, let's as you say, deplatform this guy and make him fight for his voice. And that is about as un-American as it gets. And these companies, the regulatory piece that needs to happen here is these companies need to be made into they're journalistic platforms. They're not neutral. And so they need to be publishing companies. That's what needs to happen. And that will change dramatically their business model.
Speaking of media platforms, I wanted to ask you this, and obviously you're allowed to not answer it if you want. It's just something I was curious about. Earlier this year, last year you were on with us twice, And I remember you were a regular on CNN. Every time that you would come on the podcast, you were doing CNN that same day. I know, you know, on Twitter, I think it's safe to say you've been vocally pro-President Trump. And now I've noticed you've become more of a regular on Fox News. Any reason behind that?
No, I mean, I've been pretty regular on Fox for a long time. CNN, I think, was having me on as sort of the center right guy, to foil their, you know, super left people. And but now they don't even pretend anymore. So, and I just got a note that, you know, Hannity asked if I'd be on to talk about this topic with the Special Forces soldier. Yeah, I've always done a lot of Fox, and you know, ever since I retired in 2009, and you know, I feel like I call it as I see it, and I don't get hyper political in one way or the other. I get energized about things, no doubt, but I don't get super political for sure.
Yeah, I mean, after reading the piece, I don't think it was political in any way. I thought it was a pretty straightforward piece about what actually went down and, you know, if Trump is within his right. As you said, him tweeting about it, definitely unconventional, but is it illegal? No.
And let's just give listeners the title of the article so they can go read it for themselves. It's General Anthony Tata. Trump is perfectly within his authority to review case of Green Beret charged with murder. It's up on Fox News now. So you can go check it out, read it for yourself.
Thank you. And thanks, guys. And always enjoy being on, Ian, and great chat with you, Jack. So
you too. Thank
you. You guys have a wonderful day.
Absolutely. And once again, the website is ajtata.com, ajtata.com, which has links to your Instagram, Twitter, and I guess newer Facebook, because I didn't know about what happened.
Yeah, I got it back after like a week of darkness wandering through the social media universe without any ability to see my way. So no, I'm just joking. It did take about a week to get back, but it was actually a pretty nice week off from all of that. So
yeah, and it sounds like in the end it inspired a book that will hopefully be another bestseller for you. So
yeah, it should be.
And also looking behind me, I have your signature here on the Who Dares Win. So you're welcome to come back in anytime. We're in a different location now, which is actually quite closer to Fox.
Okay, great. Great. Well, I hope to see you next time I'm in the city, Ian and Jack.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate your time today.
Take care.
Thanks. So two guests this episode, which I guess makes up for the last three episodes have been shorter. I mean, I thought they were good, but just shorter. They were about 40 minutes long. So hope you guys enjoyed both of those. And thanks as always to General Tata and coming on last minute with us. I mean, I literally texted him right before we started recording because I saw the piece and he was like, yeah, sure, I'll come on, and worked out. So be sure to check out Crate Club. We have a lot of new stuff on the horizon, a lot of custom made products. Scott Whitner has been working with a lot of the guys from the site and Brandon Webb, of course, for that to happen in 2019, everything from sunglass cases to EDC bags and other manly products. It's a club for men, by men. You can check that all out at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us. And everybody who was at the party, which, by the way, was awesome, got a bag from, you know, a bunch of Crate Club products. I had a great time, actually. I ended up staying way longer than I expected to.
Sushi was good.
Yeah. Yeah, a sushi chef there. And, I mean, really fun time and a great team of people that we now have. And to be honest, like, the turnout for how big this place was, it was nice and spacious, which I liked. Like, what was it, like three or four floors?
Yeah, something like that.
I think the only person other than that mermaid who got in the pool, though, was Brandon Webb. I don't think anyone else was in the pool.
The mermaid didn't look too happy.
All right. Also, as a reminder for those listening, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel. That's our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops Channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country, everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops Channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership. I also wanted to mention, I mean, speaking of Trump on Twitter, I thought it was pretty interesting. Dan Crenshaw's tweet to the president after the president said, I think this is one of those tweets he writes just to piss people off and knows it makes no sense, but said that, you know, these biased news sources, and then he somehow lumped Saturday Night Live.
So biased against me.
And how is this legal? And Dan Crenshaw basically retweeted it and said, you know, yes, the media is biased. So they spin things and it should absolutely 100% remain legal. This is the First Amendment and it's the backbone of our country. And although I don't think he was saying anything that profound that most of us agree with, what I think is interesting is he's a freshman congressman who's a Republican, and people assume don't rock the boat. You got to get in line with the party. And usually that's the last thing a newly elected congressman from the party does is writes a tweet critical of the president. And I applaud him for doing so.
Yeah, I mean, I like that, too. I mean, the president has, you know, his skin is paper thin. The guy, like, gets offended by Saturday Night Live. It's like, dude, stop being a baby. Like, yeah. Grow up.
And he wasn't offended when they were inviting him to come on. So,
yeah. I have to say, although I disagree with her politics, I've been loving the Ocasio-Cortez tweets.
Oh, yeah.
Those have been fun, where she's like dropping dime on like this lobbyist and that lobbyist. And I'm like, Nancy Pelosi's going to have a fucking heart attack because of this girl.
Yeah.
Talking about like ethics stuff that's going on. She's talking about what was it?
I saw the one that you liked was basically about how she's not even able to sleep over someone's house or something until she becomes a congresswoman.
Because it could be seen as an ethics breach.
Yeah, and she was like, while at the same time people are passing these tax breaks that could financially benefit them with, you know, millions of dollars, and I can't just
members
crash.
Of Congress are exempt from insider trading laws.
Yeah.
Like they're personally enriching themselves to hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, millions all the time. I mean, some of them, the ones who bring in a lot of money for their party, I mean, they're almost like right out in the open about their corruption. And you know, the way I take it is, Ocasio is, what is she like? 27, 28?
Yeah. So around there.
She's pretty young. And, you know, she's going into government all of a sudden, you know, bright eyed and bushy tailed and like seeing some of this stuff, like, holy shit.
Yeah. And you know what? I think it's good that people could say like, I don't agree with this girl, but she's still shedding light on something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's not wrong. She's a, you know, a wild communist, but, but when she's pointing out some of these, like things that I would consider corruption, I thank her for doing that.
And by the way, I think the criticism should stay with her politics. And I've seen other people talk about this. It does look, I don't think it looks good for the other side when their criticism of her is, you know, she got elected to Congress and yet she can't afford a place in D.C. I mean, I think it makes you look wildly out of touch. She, you know, is a bartender working a regular New York City job, and she was able to gain the momentum to get elected. And I mean, it does seem out of touch when you're telling a girl in her, you know, late 20s, why can't you afford a place?
Well, especially if you're the same type of person that's like, we need term limits. Why can't we get Joe Sixpack into office? Why can't he represent us? Well, Joe Sixpack is a plumber, man. He can't afford rent in Washington, D.C. either. Yeah. You know, I mean,
she is definitely of the people. There's no.
Imagine if we had more blue collar people elected to government. I mean, I'm not saying that's necessarily like we should have Joe the plumber running our entire government, of course. You know, but at the same time, if we had more people who come out of those types of backgrounds, I think the country would be a different place for sure.
In a lot of ways, Trump is, you know, like the rich version of Joe the plumber.
You know, one of the funniest things I heard about Trump is like, Donald Trump is like how poor people think rich people live their lives. You know what I mean? With all like the golden curtain rods and, you know, how his like Trump Tower, it's like, you know, where he lives, it looks like one of Saddam Hussein's palaces.
It does.
Like that's not how rich people really live. I mean, and it also goes to how like Trump wants his name on everything in New York City.
He always has been
the people who actually are the real shot callers here in Manhattan, the people who are real names, real power players in real estate. they are so below the radar, it's not even funny. And they do everything they can to stay below the radar. They don't want you to know who they were, who they are, or what they own. You know, a friend of mine who works in construction in New York City was telling me about how Michael Bloomberg owns tons of tons of buildings. Well, most people, and I've even spoken to friends of Michael Bloomberg, who think that he made all of his money and all of his money is tied up in that little finance newspaper, which I'm sure he made tons of money off of. Mm-hmm. But they don't realize that he owns buildings all over Manhattan. And my buddy who's in construction, he was telling me, he's like, if you mention the name Bloomberg on one of his work sites, you're getting kicked off.
Wow.
Like, that's how secretive it is. Like, you're off, out, done. Just mention the name. So there's all these, there's like code words and stuff. It'll be like the XYZ project or whatever the fuck, you know? So the people who are the real power players, I mean, they're below the radar. You don't know their names. You don't know who they are. And Donald Trump is out there, out front with everything all the time.
Whenever all the stuff that Bloomberg owns gets mentioned, this is the most random story, but I remember when my dad transitioned from being... It's funny, I hear the word transition, thinking transgender. My dad didn't transition that way. No, transition from telecommunications to working as a title closer. And he had to take this class on just like the basic forms and stuff. And apparently the whole class was, I think, like Haitian immigrants and stuff. And there's this sheet that everybody uses in title closing. And it's called, it's run by Bloomberg, apparently. And I always remember my dad coming home and saying the guy who taught the class was saying, and now this man, he the mayor. And my dad was like, no, this is Bloomberg. It's not Bloomberg. But I always think of that for some reason. But I mean, yeah, obviously the guy owns a lot. Do you remember when he, do you remember also when he was flying his helicopter, private helicopter, and basically like they told him during certain hours, you cannot fly your helicopter. And he got a bunch of crap for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It just goes to, in my opinion, the view of him in particular, that like the rules don't apply to him. He was a guy who didn't want, who was for term limits, and then he basically helped to elect himself a third term. And
yeah, well, I mean, I always remember about Bloomberg is, you know, 2008 hit. People were super, super pissed at the banks and the hedge funds and everyone else, rightfully so. And a Goldman Sachs executive, somebody who's pretty high up there, published an op-ed in the New York Times, like talking about how fucked up Goldman Sachs is. And he's like, you know, we used to be a company where people could trust their money, you know, trust that we're doing the right thing with their money. And he's like, now I hear the executives referring to our clients as Muppets and all kinds of stuff. He's like, this company's fucked up. And the day after that op-ed went out, Mayor Bloomberg runs down to Goldman Sachs, has a meeting with them. I mean, the masters of the universe. I mean, you know who's really running things.
Are you saying it's the Jews, Jack? No. Masters of the universe talking about a powerful Jewish man? No.
No, that's not where I was going with that. I was talking about high finance.
I'm obviously just joking. Especially
some of whom are Jewish, yes.
You're using those code words, Jack.
The JQ. You know what the JQ is, right?
Jewish something?
The Jewish question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I kind of track the alt-right people a little bit, and so I'm familiar with all the terminology they use.
That one I haven't
the
heard.
The JQ. That's going to keep you up at night. You're going to be staring at the ceiling, Ian, asking yourself about the JQ.
I'll look it up. I'm very interested in all this stuff. I think, you know, I like to know who these kind of fringe groups are in America. So
I can... We should do like a whole show about that probably, because I know we talked about it a long time when I went on my little rant about the left-wing vets. We should probably do a show about the stuff that's happening on the far right, because there's some creepy stuff going on there.
Do you remember the guy who sent a huge, long, rambling letter to us?
It was at
SiriusXM. And it was all about how the Vatican is running everything, the Catholic Church is running America.
Was that the one where it was like size 10 font?
Yeah,
it was
like
10 pages.
Yep.
And he had all this like weird stuff about how like the Jews are doing this and
I remember it was mostly about the Vatican.
It's all lumped in there. The person who wrote that was probably paranoid schizophrenic.
Oh, definitely. And he sent one to me. He sent one to you.
We all got one.
Yeah.
Yeah. We still get those email. People send us emails sometimes.
It's more interesting, though, when you get an actual letter
than an email. Too. Yeah. There's no white powder in it, though.
Yeah.
I mean, thank God for that.
I'd prefer rambling. I mean, it makes me laugh, actually. So it's, you know, there's no harm done.
The lizard people. I'd have to go like dig up through all of my emails and I could like show you guys stuff that'll like boggle your mind.
Yeah, that's David Icke, the reptilians.
The reptilians, yeah.
That, you know, Hillary Clinton is literally a reptile.
If you watch the video closely, you can see her eyes change to yellow.
Shape-shifting.
Pedophile lizard people.
And then there's also, you probably could bring in an expert on to refute this one, the people who believe in chemtrails and...
Yeah, chemtrails. The other thing I think is really interesting is the phenomena of people who, what they call gang stalking. They think that there's like secret agents following them around everywhere they go and bombarding them with like electronic waves, manipulating their minds and things like that.
Is that like... what's it called? MK Ultra.
Yeah, it all plays into that. And the New York Times actually did a pretty interesting article because what it was saying is, you know, with the prevalence of the internet and social media and so on, all of these people are they come together now and they can have like meetings and conferences,
yeah.
and it creates sort of like a self-reinforcing feedback loop that it's like, oh, this is happening to you, me too, and you know, it makes the reality more real.
Yeah, I did see that there's like a national Flat Earth conference every year.
Really? Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, there's probably stuff for everything. That would be an interesting one, just a fringe group, you know, extremists.
There's a lot. I was looking at one the other day. It's I can't remember the name of the group offhand, but they're based in Britain, and they are essentially pagan Satanist Nazis. it's like a little subculture.
What's honestly scary is when any of these people who believe in these things get elected, and it does happen, whether it's to state office or, you know, less often to national office. I mean, there was a time where David Duke was like a state representative. He almost got elected to congressman. He's also run for president, not that he had any chance.
I think it's very complicated to get into all of this, but I and there's a lot of different angles to look at it, but I would offer a few thoughts. I'd say one is that our government is failing and has been failing for several decades now to provide a national narrative about who we are and where we're going and what we're trying to accomplish. I feel like we kind of lost that after the Cold War. And what comes in to fill that void are a lot of other voices. And some of them are good voices and some of them are bad voices. And I think that... Right now, again, we're in a feedback loop from my perspective because, you know, racism has always existed in America. Anti-Semitism has always existed.
And in the world.
In the world. Right. And now, but I feel that the left, the far left, has made some really big strategic mistakes. And what they're doing is advancing identity politics. So what they're saying is that every identity should be celebrated. That you have an identity, that is your primary identity, is your race, your gender, your orientation, whatever it is. And all these things need to be celebrated except for one. There's one identity that's bad, and that is the white male. The white male is the bad identity. And what that does is there are people like me who shrug it off and we're like, yeah, well, go fuck yourself, you know, yeah. Whatever. But then there's going to be a lot of people who that issue of identity is so important. And if you crush the identity of white men, a lot of them are going to be thrown into chaos. They're going to be thrown into this sort of like existential crisis and they're going to go out looking for an identity. And now whose hands are they going to fall into? They're going to fall into the alt-right, to neo-Nazi groups. Because what they're saying essentially is they're looking at the far left and their identity politics, and they're saying, you know what? Those guys over there are right. They're right about identity politics. It's all about race. It's all about your racial identity. And now the white male needs to accept that fact. You have to realize that you belong to the white race and you have to defend your race. So that's what I mean when I say it's a feedback loop, mm-hmm. that they're unintentionally creating a feeder mechanism that's going to put disenfranchised white people into the hands of extremist organizations. And I'm sure the this is something that the far left doesn't want to hear, and I'm sure they'll refute it vigorously. but that's kind of my fear with extremist groups right now. And I think that because we don't have a mission statement as a country because we don't have a grand narrative anymore, that it has left the door open for people to drift towards extremist ideologies on the far left or the far right. That when you get into this kind of like alt-right type stuff, or you get into Antifa, you get to belong to a group, you get to have a group identity, and you get to feel like you're a little bit more clever than everyone else, that you've cracked the code, that you've been red-pilled. That's the other term they like to use.
Yeah.
You've been red-pilled, and now you can see the truth. Now you're woke.
And I don't think it helps to silence these people, because then you feel like you're part of an even more oppressed group.
Right.
You know, with
now you're part of an insurgency. You're part of the underground. It's exciting, right?
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned during the interview with AJ Tata, you know, Gavin McGinnis and the Proud Boys and this whole movement. And I think it adds some mystique to it.
Yes.
When you kick this guy off of all platforms.
It's like smoking marijuana when you're 16 years old or something like that. Your parents are like, no, don't do that. That's dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, it's a forbidden fruit. But, you know, the far left is really into the deplatforming aspect. It's kind of a key facet of the anti-fascist ideology in Europe, which is kind of coming over here now. It's counterproductive over the long haul, because what you just said, that you're creating this sort of romanticized revolutionary group. The other thing you're doing is you're driving these people further underground. So if they are on Twitter and they're on Facebook and all this kind of crap, and as much as we don't want to see their bullshit, at least you can monitor what they're doing and what they're saying. And you can look at their messaging. You know, it reminds me of our dean when I went to Columbia University, and they had a Metamajad.
Ahmadinejad
from Iran to come and speak at Columbia. And our dean was like, you know, the right hated us for doing that, but he's like, would I have Hitler come here and speak in 1933? Hell yeah, because now people understand how stupid this guy is, and they understand how full of shit he is.
Yeah. You know what I thought was interesting about that speech? I don't know if you remember, and it kind of spoke to the people in Columbia, the university, was I remember Ahmadinejad said all these horrible things about America, about the West, and the audience just listened to that. But then when he went on to the anti-gay stuff, that's when they started booing. You know, and I felt like, why, you know, if you're going to boo, I would boo all of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're on the far left, that's what kind of unites people together is the anti-Americanism, which is another thing I find concerning. Now, I know you're a big advocate of the horseshoe theory and all that, and I'm not like so much into that. I think if you look at the far left and the far right, they do join forces on some certain issues like authoritarianism, right? Mm-hmm. It does come full circle. They're also united in the anti-Americanism. The Antifa types, the communists, anarcho-communists, and the alt-right neo-Nazi types, they are anti-American. They hate our Constitution. They want to destroy the U.S. Constitution and rebuild something else. They're both communalists. They want to create a community around identity. So there are many differences between the two. I don't want to make childish, like, say this is like that, because they are very different, the far left and far right. But they have a few things in common as well.
Yeah. I mean, if you watch some of the Gavin McGinnis stuff, who, by the way, you know, I've met and is honestly a nice guy in person. I know the Proud Boys thing started almost as a joke, but the clips that have been pulled of why he should be deplatformed, of him advocating violence, it's really the same thing as Antifa advocating violence, and they're advocating violence against each other. I don't think, you know, to be fair, I don't think Antifa has like a Gavin McGinnis public figure who's out there who has like a presence on a certain network, which he did get kicked off CRTV. So,
yeah, well, I mean, the thing about Antifa and their stupidity is that they think they're still in the 1980s, like doing this like black bloc anarchy thing, like they're protesting a fucking G11 summit in Toronto in 1998. It's like, no, dude, that's over.
Yeah.
And in that sense, in the you know, they're still wearing the black ski masks and all that kind of bullshit. The alt-right people, they're actually quite a bit smarter, I think, as far as their messaging and how they approach things, because what they're doing is they're taking that The days of the skinheads and the Aryan Nation, like, that's over, that's done. The alt-right today, the white supremacy of today, they're finding ways to make it cool and hip and how to package it and market it to a younger generation of people. And in that sense, I think the alt-right is actually more dangerous at this moment because they are more sophisticated in how they're selling their message. Antifa is still like, it feels like they're in vapor lock in the 1980s or something. I don't know what the hell they're thinking.
So out of curiosity, since you mentioned it, were you there when Ahmadinejad spoke at Columbia?
No, I wasn't there. I think
that was before your time, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was in the army when that happened.
Got you. Yeah. Okay. Would you have gone?
I don't know. I tend to avoid those kinds of things. I don't think I would have gone.
Yeah. I mean, but it is an interesting thing. Just like, you know, it was probably interesting for you to get to, interview Assad, you know, like you're in the room with this guy who many want killed.
Well, I mean, working as a journalist, I reserve the right to talk to any person anytime. You know, and sometimes you have to interview people who are extremists and I disagree with politically or whatever else. But, you know, if you're a journalist and you're trying to cover these things, you know, you have to go and talk to people.
Yeah. Well, this has been a good one. Great two interviews and a random discussion after, which we often get into. I think probably it's been like boiling inside of us since I've been away for a whole week and I'm used to seeing you twice a week.
Yeah.
I think I missed this.
And now we got to film, and I'm a little nervous about it, but we got to film my news segment.
Yeah.
We're doing that. And then I'm not sure what the company wants to do with that. I think it's going to be on IGTV.
Cool.
And I imagine it'll end up on YouTube. All right, I'm going to do a bi-weekly news segment.
So. Yeah, so be on the lookout.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter @SoftRep Radio.